Hey everybody, Matt Major from Growth Mode Content, and I am very excited to help kick off the very first episode of the Hack Dissection podcast with our man Mike Lisi from Maltech Solutions. What's going on, Mike?
Not much. Happy to be here. Happy to get this thing off the ground, and you know, I really appreciate you helping me get this thing started here.
I am too. We're very excited to have you. You know, as folks know, I'm a tech guy, so I'm very much into this world, but I am not a cybersecurity expert. And to have somebody here who is, and to have some of these stories, and listen, we've been prepping this obviously for a while. We've been talking about this, going over these things, and the stories that you have from crazy breaches, the way people have been able to get in, the way you do your work, you and your team does their work, how they basically act like a hacker. You know, it's literally like a movie sort of thing that you do for a living. And then you save companies huge amounts of money, and you prevent these massive losses in the hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of dollars your work has a positive impact on. So really excited to learn about this and peel the orange a little bit and learn about your business and you and how you got here. So,
yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting because, you know, this time around, you're going to, you know, interview me. And then in the future, I'm hoping to, you know, bring on some other interesting folks and hear their stories and some of the interesting hacks and in the reasons behind them, you know, how they can fix those things, you know. So we're flipping the script a little bit to get started. Yeah. And then, yeah, we'll see how things go moving forward. But yeah, so to get started, man, it's been a long journey to get here. Mm-hmm. I've been playing with computers since I was 13, right? So I knew like from that time that this is what I was going to do. Like my mom, even at the time, she was so funny. She was asking me when I was 16, like, what do you want for Christmas? And I said, I want the Unix System Administrator's Handbook. And she was like, you are so weird, you know?
Nerd.
Yeah. And this was back, you know, gosh, right around 2000. So it's like this stuff was still pretty new for a teenager to be getting involved with. So, you know, fast forward a number of years, I did a career in IT system administration, network administration, data programming, and then research and development for government contracting. So, you know, all of those things over the course of time just kind of led me down a different path until, you know, it was around 2012. When I got into the cybersecurity realm, and you know, really that kind of changed everything.
Yeah,
and I just didn't, you know, I went down that road, never looked back. So I've been doing that ever since.
All started with the big red book that doesn't fit on a shelf.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, for the most part. At the time, I was working for a defense contractor, and we had some folks on my team that were skilled in many different areas. So one of the things that we got to do is one of the government departments called up and they said, hey, we need somebody that can help us like do an assessment of our network, right? And see if there's ways that you can break the security measures that we had in place. And I didn't know that was even a thing that we could do. And I was completely ignorant of that whole process, but we had people on my team that were very knowledgeable. So I got to shadow them. And the things that they were doing were crazy, right? We were tapping into the phone systems and recording calls and jumping across to, you know, different network segments and just doing all these really interesting things that all I heard about was just like that criminals were doing, right?
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'm intrigued. You know, let's learn a little bit more. And then later on, I think it was maybe a year later, there was a competition that people in the company were participating in. It's called Capture the Flag.
Okay.
And during that, we got to try and do all these little challenges, these little hacks, these little, you know, things that we're trying to do in order to try and qualify for like a multinational event. And the team that I was helping out qualified. So we got a trip to Las Vegas.
Wow.
On the company dime, which was great. And we got to participate in, you know, one of the biggest CTF events that is held, you know, just in general at DEF CON. So as soon as we went down that road, I was like, this is all I want to do. You know, I just dropped basically everything else, started studying offensive cybersecurity, wow, getting certifications, and that's where I've been ever since.
That's incredible. You know, you're giving us a little bit of a background on how you came to your professional career. Tell me about that first step, though, in cybersecurity. You know, did you start out immediately as an entrepreneur, a freelancer in your business, or did you go work with somebody in cyber?
I started off once I had the idea in mind that I wanted to do this offensive work, the penetration testing type of work. Mm-hmm. I went and I got the best certification that was available at the time, which was pretty well respected and pretty well known, but not widely adopted yet. It was called the Offensive Security Certified Professional, okay. OSCP. It was a very difficult exam. In fact, in order to pass it, you had to break into 5 machines that you had never seen before inside of 24 hours, get full administrative access to it, and then pull down some proof to show that you had compromised them. It took me 22 and a half hours, no sleep. And I finished all of those and I was like, okay, cool. That's what I wanted to do. And then through a cybersecurity conference, there was a recruiter there and she gave a talk just about cybersecurity recruiting and stuff in general. And I had seen later that that company was hiring. So I had no consulting experience, no actual professional experience doing penetration testing. I just had all of my knowledge leading up to that from my previous careers and that certification. And this was back in 2013. So the field was still kind of evolving. It was a little bit easier to break in. And they gave me a shot. They said, hey, come on, join us. We'll throw you at it. And it was just kind of like, you know, right into the ocean of trying to, you know, secure companies by breaking into them.
I think what's very interesting that a lot of people don't know, and unfortunately this opportunity, I don't know that necessarily exists anymore, but as we came up, and you're a little younger than me, but as we came up in the IT industry, in the technology industry, the industry was coming up, right? And you didn't have people that had 20 years of experience in 3 degrees in this field. This field didn't exist 8 months ago, in some cases, you know what I mean? And so if you were a ambitious, motivated person in this field, like yourself, like I was in traditional IT, and you took it upon yourself to learn these things and you could demonstrate these skills, that was the best resume you could ever build. And you could walk into any position, you know, that you were interested in, because you could show what is the closest to credentials there were at the time, you know? And I think that was awesome. I think that you and I were probably very lucky in our respective fields because we had that. New folks, unfortunately, now face that competition and experience and things like that. But how do you find now that you're not just one person, now that you've got this whole company, Maltech Solutions, you got a group of people working with you, how do you go about finding those and making that transition from one person to a team?
It really happened organically over time, right? So I started Maltech Solutions in 2021 as a way for me to be able to support other initiatives on top of the consulting side. The company I was working for was phenomenal. Like, I had no issues with them at all. But a consulting lifestyle working for somebody else made it very difficult to, say, help students, right? Which is one of the things that was really important to me, is giving others the knowledge that I've gained and that I've learned over time to help better prepare them for the industry. So I decided I would take a step back a little bit, do some freelancing, and just, you know, kind of feel it out and see how things went. And over time, that just kept growing, right? So I was finding new partnerships, finding some other subcontracts and things. And, you know, I met people through security meetups and those things. And I said, in this case, my full-time employee, Graham, that's on my team. He was the first hire that I made. I had him come in and he just like was really interested in getting involved. So I had him come in and shadow, brought him on as an intern and as a part-timer. And then we just kept getting more work. So I was able to actually give him a career here. And get him started with that. And, you know, that just has continued to be the case year over year, that we're, you know, making new connections, networking a lot more, and, you know, doing things like this podcast.
Sure.
In order to, you know, try and reach more companies and just like, you know, use our knowledge and our expertise to help them out.
That's incredible. And, you know, we want to talk a little bit more about some of your experience and your specific experiences. But I want to just give a little bit of a tease, I guess, and just tell us one of these things that you do on a regular basis that you find the most fun out of this career.
Honestly, it's getting to see so many businesses and industries and how they work and the challenges that they face that you don't see from a public perspective, right?
Okay.
there's so many super talented people that have tons of knowledge, tons of experience, but they're constrained in different ways, or they're limited in being able to do what they are trying to accomplish. And that they need, you know, folks like us to come in and try and show them how their company, how their products, how their applications can be vulnerable and targeted, which could have huge implications, huge impacts for them. And sometimes they need this demonstration so they can get the actual backing from, you know, the senior management team or whoever the case may be in that organization to be willing to, you know, put up the money or the support or the training that's required in order to better protect them. So it's the same types of problems on every industry. And I've even learned, you know, this past year, I got to travel down to Brazil, even internationally, they're facing the same problem, but they still have so many people that are extremely talented, extremely knowledgeable, and just trying to do like the right thing.
Yeah. If you could talk a little more about that, you know, you mentioned your trip to Brazil, but I know a lot of your time and a lot of your, I would say, professional value comes in your ongoing continuing education and networking with other professionals. Tell us a little bit how you do that and how you've made that really part of your, I don't know if that's a business model or life, I guess. What's your philosophy on that?
Yeah, it's a big mix. Like, I am a big fan of going to the local or national security conferences. Mm-hmm. There's many of them that are held hundreds every year across the country, internationally. And it's, you know, a lot of the same people often coming together, sharing their stories, sharing their research, their knowledge, their tools, techniques, all of those things. Just for the greater good of everybody else kind of learning together, you know, the industry, there's so many people in the cybersecurity industry that are just happy to share what they know and not just like hold it tight and use it as their leverage or their secret thing, because there's just so many people that need the assistance. So staying on top of it by going to those events, volunteering for those events, or just being involved as an organizer or anything like that has just opened the door to so many new relationships that I just would never have expected. You know, I remember I went to DEF CON one year, and every time I'm out in Vegas, I got to go to Gordon Ramsay's and get a steak, right? I got to go do that. So I sat at the bar, and it was during the conference, and there was a gentleman next to me, and I was like, "Oh yeah, hey, how are you? You know, what's your name? What do you do?" And he said, "You know, I'm the global head of offensive security for JP Morgan," or whatever. You know, like one of these huge international, like very important person in a very huge company. And we're just sitting there sharing a steak. You know what I mean? So it's just like an awesome opportunity to learn from somebody that I would have no ability to really interact with otherwise.
Yeah.
Those are the things that really help to drive and understand more and stay on top of, you know, what's happening and how to, you know, just be informed about, you know, where things are going.
So if we could dig into that just a little bit, because knowing this community a little bit, knowing this type of person, I think it's fair to say that a lot of folks are a little bit of that stereotype of the person, you know, the hacker in the hoodie who wants to be in his dark room and never leave. And in many cases, and this is not just in cyber, but in all kind of technical aspects, there's a lot of us who are very antisocial. So what advice do you give to folks that want to get into this and they want to learn more and take advantage of these things, but they have that problem that we all have, you know, we're not necessarily comfortable in a room full of people. How do you navigate that?
Well, there's a couple options that somebody could pursue. Number one is get involved with some of the online communities that are there, right? So that doesn't kind of force you to be out in, you know, a public space and surrounded by people and, you know, putting yourself into an uncomfortable position. There's lots of different groups and communities that you can be a part of and help contribute to without kind of putting yourself out there. I was very much that type of person before I started my company, right? I was just focused on getting the stuff done. You know, I attended some of these conferences and things, but I didn't really get involved. I always just kind of felt like an observer and just like, that's too much. And as I started getting more involved, it just became like super fun. Like, it was just so entertaining to be part of it that it was just like, oh, I don't even want to be an attendee anymore. I just want to be involved in whatever capacity because you just get so much more out of that. So there's ways to be involved in those communities without having to be like overly social, if that's not your thing, but really to help support those and to make things like work the way that, that they need to work with your contributions and with your knowledge and skills.
That's great. I think that's great advice because like I said, I think that, legitimately is an issue for some folks. Some incredibly brilliant, talented folks. And the thing that I would say to that for them is to keep in mind that these are your people, you know, chances are, like Mike just talked about, almost everybody in that room is in that same boat, has those similar feelings. And, you know, don't let that be the hesitation. And even I would go so far as to say, be open about it, you know, because you're likely to find somebody in the same situation who's more than happy to be empathetic and share how they got through it. And I just think that's a great thing.
Yeah, you know, you're totally right. I still feel that same way, you know, 10 years later that, you know, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
Like, do I even know what I'm doing? Because there's so many people that are so incredibly smart and things that I'm completely unaware of. So it takes time and effort to, you know, and one of the things I try to tell people is like, focus on your progress and your, you know, improvements that you've made versus you a year ago, not against somebody that spent a decade looking at one particular thing or super knowledgeable. Like, if you can go that route, if that's what your focus is, but if you're always trying to compare to everybody else, you're always just going to feel like you're, you know, not up to that same level.
Use yourself as the gauge for success.
100%.
I love that. I think that's brilliant, brilliant advice. So we've talked a little bit about these groups, but if we can, just to give them some love, you got the Red Team Village shirt on. Some of these organizations, the things you're talking about, they've got specific names. So what are these places that folks might want to check out to learn more about this stuff?
Yeah. So you can, first of all, there's the different conferences across the country, which there's a website that I try and keep track of. It's I think it's infosec-conferences.com. Lists so many of the things that are happening nearby in the country. You can filter it, which is a great way to attend some of those. And then as part of those conferences, there's sometimes like communities that support those conferences.
Okay.
One of the big things that's growing specifically at DEF CON is this concept of a village, right? And what you have is people that are really interested or knowledgeable about a very special intro, like a special topic or, you know, a segment of cybersecurity. And they put on content inside of this conference that's just focused on that. So one is Red Team Village, where we focus on offensive security, Red Team Operations, right? Like, so threat emulations, learning how to transition from like a pen tester into red teaming, how to develop some of those skills, doing workshops. You'll have other ones that are like car hacking, right? Or satellite hacking. Voting machines. So if you're interested in any of those types of things, you can go and talk to people that are super like passionate about.
Very, very niche.
Yeah. And you can just like totally dive in and learn a ton of stuff from them. So Red Team Villages is an organization that I'm part of. I was just elected president of that. It's a nonprofit. So we put on.
So these are whole. This isn't just like a separate room that the conference puts out. It's a whole different organizations within the bigger conference that come together.
It's specifically like people build an entire nonprofit. We get sponsorship money from cybersecurity companies and stuff, and then we bring in speakers and we kind of like carve out our own little set of like, you know, sessions and stuff that are taking place during that conference. So you can go to the main conference, take in everything there is to offer there. And then if you're interested in like these different, you know, areas of cybersecurity, you can go visit a village. And that concept is spreading quite a bit. And, you know, we're starting to support other initiatives outside of DEF CON where we can have a presence there and help people like, you know, be directed towards resources, towards training. We put on free workshops. We did a whole 8-hour session 2 weeks ago, just online, and just to help people out.
And for those who don't know, red team and blue team are specific terms, right, in the cybersecurity world. Can you just explain a little bit what some of those, it's like some of the only terms that aren't an acronym. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, it comes from like a lot of it comes from military, you know, linguistics and stuff. So what you have is the concept of typically you have the blue team, which are the defenders, the good guys, you know, trying to protect and keep all the bad guys from
same
doing
as Call of Duty,
objective.
Right?
Yeah. And then you have the red team now, which is, you know, the bad guys are the attackers that are trying to disrupt or, you know, destroy or do something against the blue team. So, you know, in cybersecurity, we have those same kind of roles. We have the people that are trying to defend and protect their systems against attacks. And then you have the red team, which are there to emulate those realistic threats, those realistic actors and exploiting those vulnerabilities to demonstrate the impact. You know, there was somebody in industry, Graham Helton, and he basically said, I don't think that like the offensive security stuff should exist, but it has to exist because we need to demonstrate the impact in order for organizations to take the appropriate steps. And I think he's right.
You're effectively the good guys who act like the bad guys.
Yeah, 100%.
That's incredible. Yeah. Mike, we've been talking a lot about kind of the industry, and I think a lot of great information for folks that might want to get into your industry. But we should talk about the other side. We should talk about your customers and the everyday businesses that might need your service. So first and foremost, who are they? Who hires you?
Well, it's a little bit of everybody, to be honest. Over the years that I've been operating in this capacity for companies that I've worked for, direct customers, and companies that I've done assessments for via partnerships or other contracts, it's spanned like every kind of industry. I've helped healthcare. I've helped schools and universities. We've helped law firms. We've helped government, county, you know, government level, you know, entities, manufacturing industry, e-commerce, farming.
Wow.
Like it's just the entire gamut of everything. There's something to be gained from any organization that has something to protect, right? There's something that they're trying not to get disclosed, or maybe, you know, they don't want all their systems taken offline or whatever. All of those are potential opportunities for getting an offensive kind of assessment to see, like, are the things that we're doing effective? Are they working the way that we expect them to? And how can we test this safely without actually getting compromised and being down or offline or, you know, just completely, you know, inoperable. So that's where we kind of come in to assist there.
When you do that sort of, I guess we'll say red team, you know, penetration testing of that nature, obviously if you're successful or maybe even not completely successful, you have the potential to take things offline.
Sure.
Do you go through and do that as a matter of your test?
It is not a matter of our testing, right? Our testing is meant to be non-disruptive to users, to systems. So those are always off the table, right?
Yeah.
We're not trying to impact their actual business operations.
So you're not going to actually do what the bad guy might do, at least the last step, the actual damage, right?
Sure. Yeah, exactly. It can happen unintentionally.
Sure.
But for the most part, you know, we try and steer clear of that. And basically, if we get to that point where there's the potential, we'll pause and inform the customer, like, hey, here's where things are at. Here's the impacts that can be had. We're not going to go further, but this is what you can do to protect against that should somebody get to that same point. And on there's a little bit of a discrepancy too. In my view, there's always, you know, people that have their ideas of what's a penetration test, what's a red team, you know, what's whatever. So in my view, like the penetration testing is, you know, working with the customer to try and identify and demonstrate impacts from vulnerabilities that can exist. The red team side is more advanced. Like it's a level above us, right? It's more, hey, we want you to emulate Russia or China, and these tactics that they use so we can make sure that we're identifying them and flagging them and doing those things. So it's like a very specialized set of skills and techniques. So it's almost like you're kind of leveling up over time as an organization. Like you have your vulnerability level things, like just catching the stuff that, you know, folks like at the local IT department are helping to protect against. And then the next level up is like, okay, well, let's see if those are effective enough or if there's gaps that those other tools and things haven't assisted with. And then we'll demonstrate that those are working properly. And then if they really have specific concerns, then they can go that red team route and show like, okay,
I see.
We're going to get, you know, a full on, we don't know what's going to happen. We know somebody's going to target us. Let's see what occurs there. And that's like that covert level, that, you know, elite level.
If you could, Mike, explain to me how these folks come to you and why initially. And what I mean by that is it a matter of they have an IT provider like me and that person recommends, or there's been, is it just because there's been an event, or are there people that are proactive enough to just know, hey, we've got the infrastructure that we need this help? You know, mm-hmm. how does that occur usually?
It varies across industries. So in some cases, you'll have companies that are trying to implement like cyber insurance policies and things, which is obviously a pretty new thing this last 10 years. And those requirements for getting insurance are becoming more strict, mm-hmm. or they're at least looking for demonstrations that companies are taking at measures to protect themselves. So we might have customers come to us for that, right? We want to show that we're making progress towards our security in order to get a better deal. So that's one option. The second is that companies may have regulations or requirements or compliance that they have to do, right? So this is people that handle payment card processing, like in-house, right? They have to abide by PCI regulations. Yep. They need to have the segmentation verification done and get it approved by QSA. So like those things are drivers for it. You know, there's other regulations coming from the government. A couple of years ago, the FTC imposed new regulations where any company that's like collecting financial information from customers needs to demonstrate that they're protecting that, right?
Yeah.
Through monitoring or through penetration testing. And then you have companies that are just looking to do the best thing that they can, right? They want to protect their stuff. They're taking those proactive measures. And so they'll reach out and they'll say like, hey, we have something that we're trying to protect. Can you help us do this assessment and see how well it's working?
That's incredible. I mean, like you said, there's so many new and changing things in the fact that folks are finally realizing that they need this extra help is awesome. Because unfortunately what I found in the IT world is a lot of clients who don't know a lot about these things just assume that we IT guys are you and we're actually every level, you know, even the folks above you. And to have some education and understanding of the different people, the different services and things like that, I think is huge. So mm-hmm. it's great that you're sharing this information. I think it's phenomenal. How much of your work or how often are you responding to a breach, or is that not really your specialty? Are you not the guy to call once someone has broken in?
Yeah, that is not my specialty.
Great.
That is more incident response and maybe some forensic type things. That's a very specialized skill set.
Yeah.
And you want people handling that appropriately, right? Because in the case of like a breach or an incident, you want to collect all of the evidence related to that breach, any of the log data, any of the files or systems that might have been affected. And you want to make sure, you know, you're following the proper protocols, chain of custody things, and you want to have the right people in place for that. And there are lots of organizations that are very specifically skilled for that. But that's not an area where we are operating within.
Yeah.
But we have, you know, friends in the industry, other partners that we can refer to when those types of things occur.
Well, again, that's the key part of knowing, you know, what these different functions are, right? I think in many cases, too, when you're subject to that, as we talked about your insurance company, it may even be your law firm. And we've seen in many cases the law firms have those specialty breach folks who they might bring in. And I just think it's an interesting dynamic how these different industries and things you wouldn't imagine, as much how much lawyers are now involved in what we would consider a business's computer system.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's the reality of the world and the reality of the threats.
Yep.
If you could talk a little bit about, you mentioned some of these regulations, and these of course are huge drivers from the government level. Insurance is a huge driver. But aside from that, it's not just a recommendation, right? There's legitimate penalties, even if you were a victim, right?
Yeah, that's one of the big drivers here, and really the source for our little story that we're going to go through in a little bit here. But like, let's say in healthcare, right? There's HIPAA laws, mm-hmm. right, to protect medical records, electronic health records, personal information. And if those companies that house and store or process that information are not properly protecting themselves and they get breached, there's the potential for financial penalties and things. So in the case where a company that handles HIPAA, you know, protected data is compromised, there's differing levels of penalties that can be applied per occurrence, depending on how essentially negligent they were in protecting that information. So like if they didn't know anything about it or didn't know that it was a potential issue, then there's various fines. If they did know about it and didn't rectify it within a certain amount of time, those fines can be much higher, up into the tens of thousands per incident. So yeah, there's real drivers for companies to stay on top of that, and trying to make sure they're not getting breached or they're not having this impact.
That's incredible. And that's the piece where it kind of comes back full circle, right? To you, what you're doing with those initial tests before the bad guys run their tests, you know? Last thing I want to ask you about that, and then I really want to hear about some of this live action stuff that you do. We're talking a lot about penetration tests. If I go on the internet and I Google, I want a penetration test, I will get a bunch of options for $500, $999, whatever. Quick, easy, compliant penetration test. And, you know, usually you give them your website and end of story, right? And that's supposed to be a penetration test. Is it? What is happening here?
You will have organizations that offer those low cost penetration tests that are technically checking the box, right? They're doing the things that are bare minimum requirements in order to meet those obligations. That's certainly a path that many companies will follow because they don't have the funds or the time or the investment to take that a step further. So is it a penetration test? Probably yes. In some cases, I don't know how everybody operates.
Sure.
But for us, like at Maltec, we really focus on that collaborative nature and trying to find a solution that's not only practical, but affordable for each individual use case. Because, you know, if you're coming at us, and you know, you're an organization that, has very specific needs or very specific concerns, but say your budget isn't what it could be, then we can find a way to give you a practical test, that addresses those concerns and gives you a place to, start taking those measures to protect yourself. And I think that's really important because there's also the organizations that just kind of offer, you know, hey, we have a one price solution. It's, you know, $25,000 and we come in and do that, but they don't take into context the things that are important for that specific org, because what's important to one organization in one industry doesn't have the same level of impact or importance for an organization in a different industry. And after doing these for, you know, 10 years and doing hundreds of these for different companies, we've really learned like the types of things that they should be worried about and what's important to them. And having that open conversation really helps us to define a test and execute a test that is really in line with their needs and their requirements.
I think that's really key. And again, we're going to hear about this in just a second. But to me, as an IT provider, this is the reason we partner with you and professionals like you, because you are real people who can give context, right? It's not just that service that checks the box, which is typically, I'm going to say, mostly completely automated, right?
Likely. Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with using tools and using AI and using all of these things, but to have a person who actually can take the time to A, look at your needs and look at, you know, here's pages and pages of data. We care about these, you know, three paragraphs. The system isn't going to tell you that. You are. You're the one that's going to be able to give context to that particular business, which is why I would just, it would be silly to me. We could save some money by not getting what we need. And to me, that's wasting money. But anyway, tell us about the work, right? Like, tell me something cool about this awesome job that you get to do every day.
Everyone's like an adventure. And what I love is like hearing about a story or a test that somebody's done and just how it went. Cause you can learn not only how somebody operates, but just kind of like unique little tidbits about an industry, about, you know, a specific test case. And it just helps you grow and understand like, hey, next time I see that, I'm going to remember that little tip and see if it impacts this client here too. So the one that I came to talk about today is a company that was in the healthcare realm industry. And they came to a partner that I work with, and they basically said, hey, we have this web application. We want to test it to make sure that it's secure. We haven't been able to do like thorough testing. We have some automated tooling that kind of helps, but we really want like this manual test to make sure that the assumptions that we've made and the stuff that we've developed is secured properly. Mm-hmm. And we're, you know, awesome. We love those types of tests. So in this scenario, we were operating as a typical user, right? Somebody that logs in and is, you know, tasked with interacting with that platform and handling the you know, the transfer of records and doing those types of the activities. And the big important thing during this discussion with that client is we got to make sure that those records are secure, right? That they're only accessible by the person that is authorized to do that.
Makes sense.
So we, you know, we're operating as that. And as we're playing around and taking a look at all the different parameters and things, we identified something that was kind of easy. In the overall, the vulnerability here is kind of trivial, but the implications were just like massive.
Oh, wow.
So let's say you, let's say you're bringing up one of these records, and in the URL bar, right, in the bar at the top of your browser, you click on the record and it gives you just like, you know, it's a string of blah blah blah.com or whatever, and then an identifier for that record. And what we saw is that the record had kind of like three numerical fields. It was like, you know, like several numbers with a dash, several numbers with a dash. It was like, okay, that's fine. You know, it's just an identifier for that document. And we clicked on the next document and all of those numbers were the same, except the last number was one more, right? So we're like, okay, so that's fine. You know, it's an easy way of storing things.
Sequential.
Yeah. You just have the sequential identifier. But what we realized is that like the first set of numbers was related to a tenant, right? So in this case, the company had multiple customers that were using their platform to store these medical records. And so as a user, you're only supposed to be able to operate within your one tenant and within those records that you have access to. So we started playing around with those different numbers and putting in, you know, well, if it's not our tenant, let's try another tenant. And by playing around with all those things, we saw that, you know, there was like a tenant number, maybe, and then there was a record number itself, and then something related to like a patient, right? Like a patient identifier. So all the records associated with that person. And so by changing all those fields around, we started realizing, oh, we can access records from any tenant for any patient, any document that we want.
Just got to put in their number.
Yeah, we just have to change that because it's not something that we clicked on, right?
Right.
So normally they expect you to take that and click on the document and pull it up. But by just manipulating those parameters, we started getting access to all these other health records, which obviously that's a problem.
Yeah.
That was problem number one. The second thing that we saw is that since it was sequential and it's super easy to guess, you can automate this, right? You can throw a tool at it and say like, well, let's just see like how many records we could access, right? So we started just iterating through that first number and then just resetting that counter for the second number and the third number and just seeing which one returned a document. And, you know, there is tens of thousands of documents here. So now we're looking back and you know, obviously we stopped the testing here and we alerted the customer right away just to say like, hey, we have a big problem that, you know, there's the ability to access thousands of documents outside of our tenant. Basically, every document that you have up there is accessible by anybody that's authorized to interact with that platform, which for them isn't, you know, oh crap, like this is not at all what we want. So so we stopped. We went through a walkthrough process to show exactly how we had accessed these records, showed the impact of that, and then made some recommendations there on how they should fix it, right?
Yeah.
So that was finding number one. The second finding that was kind of a derivative finding is that automation process, right?
Yeah.
So when you have like a web application, things can operate really, really quickly. And you want to have limitations on that to restrict the potential fallout, right? So if you're sitting there and you're automating the access to these records and the use cases that somebody should just be clicking on them and looking at them for a few minutes, like if somebody can access them like 1,000 times a second, that's a problem, right?
Yeah.
So that's a different limiting factor that they didn't implement and they didn't even think about.
Sure.
Which really expanded that. So if they had this other protection in place, it would have obviously limited the fallout there. So, you know, during the course of this test, we went through all these findings. We walked through that and we just let them know, like, hey, here are the things that were missed. And here are the recommendations on how to properly mitigate this to protect it. Because as we said before, should this get breached and I downloaded all these records as an attacker and then I put them up online for sale, that company would be liable potentially to fines for each one of those documents that was in accessed like without authorization.
That's incredible. And again, that's what, ballpark, like 10 grand a record.
It really varies. The highest penalty I think is $50,000 per instance. It kind of drops down depending again on the severity and the impact and how negligent that company could be. So,
and you know, also we've talked a lot about the penalties and all these things, but we haven't really mentioned just the fallout on your business. You know,
sure,
you get breached and all those customer records are gone. Well, none of those folks are ever going to do business with you again. There's a good chance they're going to sue you. And then who else ever wants to give you their data again, you know? So there's just so many reasons that you get to do an interesting job all day long, which is the cool part, right? I love hearing about that, man. And what is the reception when you go to a client like that? Are they very happy that you found something that they can fix? Or are they upset that there was a problem to begin with?
All of the, both. Like, it really spans lots of different sorts of responses. Typically, they're very happy because they have information that they can address without it being an actual problem, right? It hasn't been breached. They can go back and do some investigation to make sure that it hasn't been compromised in the same way that we were able to find it. They can implement and work on fixes like immediately to prevent this from happening. In some cases, they are upset just because they weren't aware of that, or that somebody had taken improper shortcuts or didn't follow protocol for, you know, their coding or for their processes for protecting things, right? So, like, as an IT person, you probably have processes in place to make sure that things are protected and segmented. And if somebody were to fail to do that, you could be upset with that situation. In other cases, they take the information, we never hear from them again. So we don't really know if they're happy or not happy. Yeah. But we know that we did at least our job for it. It really runs the gamut. On the inverse side for us, it's always a conflicting set of emotions. Like, I'm happy that I've had this really impactful finding.
Yeah.
But I'm also like disappointed that these findings like existed, right? So it's kind of like one of those things where it's just like, I feel good for me, but not for them, right?
Yeah.
Because I was able to do something that is impactful. But at the end of the day, as long as, you know, the objectives and things of the test were met and everything like that, like I'm satisfied with it. You know, I don't try and like, I'm not ego driven in that sense.
Sure.
Like, hey, we wrecked you or whatever. It's like, hey, we had some things, let's talk about them and let's figure out some solutions that can be used to address those.
Yeah. That's incredible, man. Mike, Maltech Solutions is the name of the company. It's maltechsolutions.com is the website.
Yep.
Tell us what we're going to do or what more you might see and hear on this particular podcast.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that I can bring some other friends of mine in, some of my colleagues.
I think we'll let them in.
For M Industry.
We have to check them at the door, but we'll probably let them in.
A lot of them are remote, so we'll be okay. We'll be okay. Although I don't know if you want them connecting to your network.
Yeah, holy shit. That's a whole other thing.
Lots of these stories exist like from everybody in industry, right? Everybody's had this opportunity to work with a customer to try and find these vulnerabilities, exploit them. There's all these different paths that you can take. And, you know, just trying to spread that knowledge on how these things can be impacted so that really my goal here is to share those stories and then to help other organizations like maybe catch something on that and be like, oh, we might be impacted by that. Let's go back and look and see if we've gone down the same path and potentially have the same problem, or, hey, we haven't even thought about that. Maybe we should look into getting, you know, some sort of assessment done for that. And the other part of it is to spread the knowledge on what they can do to protect themselves against it. Like in the case of this web application, you know, there's two big vulnerabilities. One was the lack of authorization, which is relatively easily implemented, right? If somebody accesses a record, check to see if they should have access to that record. If not, then deny it. Like, that just wasn't in place here. The second part was those record IDs were sequential, very sure. easy to guess. So one, you know, opportunity there is to change how those record identifiers are generated, because there's ways to implement non-sequential
right.
identifiers, and then it makes it very difficult for somebody to just arbitrarily access something. The third thing is rate limiting, or putting protections mm-hmm. on how quickly somebody should be able to do something based on
yeah.
their, you know, the expected user behavior. And that's one of the ones that so many companies don't take into account, because the impact is one thing. And then if you're able to exploit something, how much data can you pull out before you're caught or shut down? And the limits that you can put on there have a huge impact on
yeah.
what that fallout looks like.
I always just think about that great line from the movie Hackers. You know, I got one user online and he's doing the workload of 10 users. I think there's a hacker.
Exactly. Yep.
That was, yep. you know, we don't all have Penn Jillette sitting there watching our screens like we had in 1995, but it's that exact thing, right? It's that's an immediate kind of alarm bell should be going off of, like, wait a minute, one person shouldn't be able to do a million tasks simultaneously,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. This person is accessing records, you know, 1,000 times a second. Should that raise a flag?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it should. Yeah. So if it's not, then let's find a way to implement those things and then test it again, right? Make sure that those flags are yeah. being raised and they're actually being addressed, because an alarm that doesn't get answered doesn't really help anybody either.
That's so critical. You know, when I think about any small amounts of software development, things like that I've done, you know, your goal as a developer is to first and foremost just make the thing work mm-hmm. in the most simplest terms. And then it gets refined and refined and refined. And then the last step is that everything's yeah. working fine. Why do I need to add all these other pieces?
Well, security is not primary concern when it's like, hey, we want a proof of concept. We want this
right.
to, even for the stuff that we develop, like, we don't test our own stuff because we're too close to it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I want somebody else that isn't as intimately involved with all the components, like finding assumptions that I've made, right? And that we've made.
Hey, what did I
trying
miss?
To fix that. Yeah.
It's for that.
And it's the same thing for like IT providers like yourself.
100%.
You know? If you're trying to assess your own security, you know the shortcuts that right. might exist there. It's like, well, is that something that I should be concerned with? Should I tell them about it? You know, there's a little bit of a conflict potentially there. So, you know, the good IT providers, the really respectable ones, are the ones that are going to be like, we want an independent
yeah.
review of this to make sure that we're doing the best job that we possibly can, because
yep.
we're here to, you know, protect you in our specific ways.
That's where we at your local IT department, we have that. And it's one of the rare situations, I think, where a lot of folks in business want to advertise the fact that they've brought in a partner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times in business, you don't want anybody to know that it's not completely you. But this is one of those cases where, at least from my perspective in our business, we want to say, hey, we're bringing in Maltech Solutions. We want to name you by name and and just make it clear that you are legitimate, and it's a check on us
mm-hmm.
that we'll step aside and you're, you know, you're a buddy of mine, but you're not going to go show up and cover for me.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You're going to make us better and make the client safer. And that's.
Yeah. Our goal isn't to make anybody look bad.
Yeah.
It's just to highlight, without, you know, specific bias, the things that can be improved upon, because sometimes it's not even like a problem with the IT department or with the MSP. You know, we've had situations in the past where people just, hey, I want to back up my laptop, so I'm just going to plug in, you know, a local backup thing onto the network.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, nobody else knows about it. It's like that shadow IT stuff that a lot of people are plugging in and nobody knows about until, hey, yeah, that backup's just wide open. So can you tell us about that so we can lock it down in the way that we're supposed to? You know, those types of things are always little gotchas that
yeah.
as somebody coming in with fresh eyes maybe can pick up on.
Users are the biggest risk. We wouldn't have to worry about anything if just nobody was allowed to touch anything.
That's true. And it should be the case where, like, the users should be allowed to make mistakes, and the technology and the stuff behind it should be configured to minimize the impact.
Where they won't end the world, yeah.
Yeah, because users are trying to get their work done.
Yeah.
They're not here to stay on top of the security, or, you know, it's mm-hmm. just not their focus. It's our focus. So we need to better inform the users, and hopefully they make better decisions.
I love that approach.
But, you know, it's not even with, like, social engineering or security awareness, we don't name specific users because it shouldn't be, you know, a situation where the user gets reprimanded for
yeah.
doing something incorrectly. It's like, well, yes, we should improve upon that, but we should also make sure that there's safeguards in place so that when they do slip up, as everybody is prone to do.
You don't believe in a wall of shame?
No, I do not. Oh, I do not.
Come on, Mike. It's always Tina from accounting's face, you know, just I don't actually know any Tinas in accounting, but it just sounded like a funny concept to me. Mike Maltech Solutions. Say the podcast name for me one more time.
Hack Dissection.
I was actually going to get it right that time, and I triple guessed myself. Anything else that we should mention in the first episode that we haven't? I know we jumped around a little bit.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think we covered a lot of those things. Great. You know, mainly just wanted to, you know, give you a little taste of what a single assessment looks like. And we get to do that every day. So it's just like a new like little puzzle to solve. And, you know, that's just one of those many stories that I could probably tell.
I love it. Well, folks, I think that does it for the pod. Tune in next time for some incredible wisdom and some incredible people who are going to be way smarter than me on the next episode. You won't have to listen to me. You're going to actually have some people who know what they're talking about. So,
and in fact,
I'm excited about that.
If anybody that's watching has a good story from a test that they've done or a hack that they've done, you know, feel free to reach out. You know, I'd have to talk to you about it and kind of go through and, you know, pick it apart, find those shortcomings, what they could do, how companies can protect it. Because, you know, there's a ton of people in the industry that are doing these tests every day. And, you know, you see the craziest stuff, and, you know, I want to hear some of those crazy stories too.
That's awesome. I love it. Mike Lisi, Matt Major. Been a good one.